and you are listening to the Long Game Podcast. This episode is a part of our Kitchen Side series, where we pull back the curtain and show you the behind-the-scenes conversations, debates, strategies, and brainstorming sessions that we have at our agency. Today's chat opens with a simple question. What should we automate? What can we automate? And when does it actually make sense? From Haro inbox hacks to multi-agent PR workflows, we weigh the promise of set-it-and-forget-it systems against the very real cost of building and QAing and maintaining these systems. That spins into a bigger discussion about preserving the messy, hands-on work that teaches junior teammates, junior employees, and keeps senior strategists sharp, the cultural tweaks required for fully remote teams, and why our in-person offsites feel like hitting the reset button on alignment, momentum, centricity, and cohesion. Along the way, we trade notes about redefining our career identities, being open-minded, adaptable, agile, taking calculated risks, and deciding sort of when it's time to bet on yourself, whether that is taking a 16-hour mountain hike like David is planning on doing, or just launching a brand new service line where you feel a little bit less comfort or certainty. Anyway, great episode. Without further ado, here is the Long Game Podcast. Just because we can doesn't mean we should automate something. I immediately inverted that and was like, just because we should also does not mean we can.
Yeah.
And those are the more frustrating scenarios.
Those are the most frustrating things. And I think
I feel like that's the crux of the industry.
I've definitely ran into a couple of those.
Like, that's the whole thing. It's like, hey, we should be automating this part, but we can't yet for some reason.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you did want to invest in automating it, I've run into this a couple of times because I keep a running list of things to automate. And maybe on a weekend or like a Friday afternoon when my brain's not really working, but I can still tinker, I'll try to automate some stuff. And one of those things is I've heard of people building out these automations for Haro emails. So if y'all get those, I'm currently subscribed. Those emails are long and there's dozens of queries. And most of the time, it's not even relevant to the point where I just archive most of them. I've heard of people creating automations where you get the email, triggers a zap, it parses out the email to figure out which ones are relevant. And then I'm jumping straight into this already because that's where my brain is. It parses out what's relevant to your business based on what you tell the agent. And then it'll just send you a separate email with the query and like the actual relevant thing. I tried to automate this and I was like, yo, this would take many, many hours to actually build in like QA. So I had to pause. But that's like an example of...
I think that's a good idea.
It is a great idea, but it wasn't something I could build in an hour. Like I need to actually sit in QA and like figure out how to parse it out correctly. And maybe I'm just not good at some of those things.
Well, but then you have to weigh like the benefits to the task itself of like, is that something that you do often enough that has enough value to you and the business to spend that time doing? Do you feel like it is?
That probably would be a valuable thing for us, but then I could imagine somebody building like a mini product you know, because like all digital PR, all content, all link building agencies, I feel like this should exist.
Yeah. Like, so just another thing, since we're on it, I was thinking, we've been thinking a lot about digital PR and we're like hiring for those roles right now. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I thought about was, what if there was like an agent that based on a given, like, let's say we have a client that's in a procurement space. There's an agent that scrapes the news, scrapes Reddit to find trending topics about software procurement or whatever. And then based on those topics, come up with digital PR ideas or blog post ideas or LinkedIn post ideas, have another agent take those ideas, turn them into posts, like LinkedIn posts or blog posts, have another agent create a video script so that if clients want to do video, they have a script ready for them. There's all this stuff that can be built, but contrary to what you see, it's pretty difficult to build some of these things and make them work.
Yeah,
like seamlessly. Is. And even the templates and out of the box stuff is hard.
I would imagine that some of the platforms will start building this in, like with the GEO products. I feel like there's this feature parity that exists right now and that everybody's doing the table stakes really well.
pinging a prompt 1,000 times, pulling it from an API, scraping it, whatever, calculating your visibility and your sentiment score and the citation sources that show up. The next step from, I have had so many conversations with all these founders. The next step is figuring out how to make that actionable. And I think all of these products have different POVs on that. But one thing that you'd mentioned there is I could imagine, you know, you're looking at the citation gaps where you don't exist, or potentially if there's just weak citations and data available for that prompt, you could say, hey, like there's a really interesting opportunity here to create a piece of original research that maps to what somebody would be searching or prompting. And here are some ideas as to how to do that. Here's an outline and here's the methodology. But I feel like that's something that's in the works. I would imagine, like, I can't believe, I mean, does Ahrefs or SEMrush do that with sort of, I mean, they have their the Content Explorer tool, right?
Ahrefs has like that brand package that tracks AI citations. It's a lot more expensive. So I don't have visibility into how it presents its like action items or recommended next steps. But I took a look at Profounds and it's quite high level. I wouldn't say it's anything that an average SEO couldn't generate from the data. But what's interesting with Profound is they have a blog writer tool. So you can like segue into content production if that is one of the recommended actions. But yeah, the LLM visibility analysis I did for one of our clients, it was really cool to point. There's just so many opportunities that come out, like the citation review, seeing not only where the brand mention gaps are, but having it justify or at least point to original research in this area, or doubling down on product pages and comparison pages. And frankly, a lot of this stuff is already built into our playbooks that we're already bringing to the table, but it's cool to have it check multiple boxes. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how the action items come out of that stuff.
That automation question is so interesting though, because David, you talked about that in one of our team meetings today about before I put the time and effort into building this workflow, do we first agree that this is a necessary step in the work that we're doing? And I think that's something that it doesn't get asked as frequently as it should, which to your Haro example is you frame the objective, like what do we want to accomplish? And then you kind of frame inputs as to getting to that objective. And then for me, at least what I do, and this is maybe like an analytical background, is I figure out what methodology would lead me to the solution. And for you in the Haro example, it's sort of a filtering or a matchmaking. It's like figuring out like among the myriad opportunities, which ones are actually relevant for me. And that's a great use case for an LLM. So you look at that as like technically feasible, but then you think, is this worth the time and effort based on the work we're doing, which is to get Haro placements or like digital PR outreach placements?
Yeah.
Kind of interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's also the like, sure, I can automate this, but it'll take 5 to 10 hours. And I can probably just scroll through that email in a minute and see if it's if there's anything relevant. So there's that other trade-off. But I've back to the topic of like things we're not automating or things we're going to automate. I think it was Ben on our team who brought this up of like, sure, we can automate a lot of that stuff, but also we need to create a space for people to become like senior strategists that work with clients. And if we automate all the junior stuff, how do we bring in junior people who will want to work with clients? And so I just spoke to another person who's in like biotech, and he was actually saying like, yeah, we don't hire any juniors anymore. Like all the analyst stuff that we used to have juniors do that he used to do himself, they used to use AI now, which is kind of crazy. And I'm like, so what happens when like all the seniors leave or like people churn out? Like, how do you replace them? Then you just hopefully hire someone else.
Well, and then how do you learn in the first place?
Yeah, that is
to become a senior, you know?
Yeah.
I think it has been interesting talking to Ben and Sam respectively about their teams and each of their approaches to automation. And we'll talk about our offsite, but he and I had a great conversation that week about automation in regards to our strategy work and SEO. And as you all know, he's like 50-50 on it. Like this portion of things can be easily automated. It's quite redundant. It doesn't use a lot of critical thinking and it's not a waste of time because it's still valuable to the work we're doing. But in the scheme of all the things we're doing, he'd rather preserve manual time for the other 50%, which not only requires critical thinking and skill, but in doing that work, it helps the team get close to the client, understand the industry, understand like the context of what's on the website. Whereas if you automate all of it away, there's not much to speak to when you get in front of the client, and you don't know, you don't sound like you know what you're talking about. So in some ways, the manual work that could be automated is actually taking away a lot of the value of working with us to begin with. So I think he struck a really good balance between the stuff that's junior and basic and tedious, and then the stuff that's still junior, but not only helps the team, you know, upskill, but really helps us know what we're talking about when we get in front of the client.
That's such an interesting point. Because then it leads to the question, like, what is valuable, or what do you deem as valuable?
Yeah.
I heard Tim Solo did a podcast, I think it was with Eric Sue, and they were talking about the value of AI note takers, which in my opinion is one of the best things that I have used in my own workflows, my own productivity. Tim actually argued that he in one-on-ones, he gets a lot of value from like having handwritten notes after the fact, because it helps you grok the information better. And then with his one-on-ones, he has both parties do notes afterwards to make sure that they understood what was discussed and they're aligned on it. Versus for me, like I can't focus that well if I'm also simultaneously like thinking about taking notes. And what it does for me is it compartmentalizes my second brain, so then I can actually use the information that was discussed in a proposal deck, in a kickoff call, in a follow-up email, you know, for action items. So it's very interesting, because I feel like there's a diverging path, even with the same activity, in that I find that incredibly useful. And to me, it's actually distracting and mundane to take notes during a call. But somebody else could have the completely different perception of that as a value add.
Yeah, it's interesting. I just did an interview earlier, and I had my Fireflies running. And I still took notes about how I was feeling about the conversation and things that stuck out to me that wouldn't have been reflected in a transcript. But then I went and I referenced the transcript for this person's answer, so I could include verbatim what they said back to my question. So it was a hybrid approach of like, I still took stuff that I probably wouldn't remember 30 minutes after. But having something take down the actual words that were used was so helpful. Yeah, that's saved my life so many times, those tools.
One thing that I think is true of most automation is that it feels like we tend to automate things that are human touch points. And maybe you were alluding to that, David, but like I don't know, you can automate notifications to people, but I feel like it has a lot more impact if you actually either pick up the phone or like shoot a Slack message and like have a face and a name and a person attached to it.
Yes.
Because then there's some accountability in the response, and it doesn't feel so generic.
Yeah.
You know, like you can obviously save time by sending a templated thing, but for me that's actually incredibly valuable to just do it myself.
It's also like if the communication is the thing that's automated, like isn't that the most important thing in everything that we're doing, like in work itself? It's like if someone were to automate text messages to friends, like birthday messages to friends,
which people are probably doing.
People definitely do. Like you do you if that's what you decide to do. But like, I remember having a thought. I was like, oh, that'd be nice. And I'm like, wait, if I don't care enough to send him a birthday message, why would I automate this? And if I were getting an automated happy birthday message, would I like that? And I think like, not only is it more impactful if it's coming from an actual person versus an automated Slack bot or something, but shows that you care, I think. And it's that effort that I think, Alex, you and I talked about on our last Kitchen Side around, like there's value in the effort. And I think what Ben is getting at is there's value in that messy process of understanding an industry versus just doing a ChatGPT deep research prompt, which gives you a lot of information, but hopefully you're digging in deeper like using it as a jumping point to go through a process and like put in that necessary, go through the necessary friction to learn and like put in to care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely with the strategic work, you have to have some level of playing around with the information in your brain before you really grok it inside and out to be able to speak to it at like beyond a service layer. I think a lot of people who are probably using AI to summarize very in-depth information, and I'm not the first person who's explored this as like a possible pitfall. Like I think Ezra Klein talked about this with writing. There's a process that entails when you start writing a long form essay where you're actually grappling with the ideas and playing around with them in your brain and writing a sentence that feels wrong to you. And then you kind of go back and you edit it and you parse out this word that felt like just it didn't describe it fully. And through that process, you sort of clarify your thinking. This was a joke, but some guy on Twitter posted about how you could summarize like the great literature with ChatGPT. Mm. It was a troll. It was a shit post, but there were a lot of people who were like, this is great.
I was like, that's kind of sad.
Well, you start thinking about that and you abstract it out to the ad absurdum, or I don't know. There's some phrase where it's like you bring it out to the fullest point where it's just absurd. And you could just summarize all literature and it just says like, you know, love, suffering, death, like let go, or, you know, it's just like the most,
that's all you need to read,
distilled boilerplate things. But like, you're not gonna
think of Gatsby.
Yeah, longing, you know, like Gatsby is longing. It's like you got to go through and understand the role of you know, Daisy Buchanan in context with Jay Gatsby to really fully embody that concept. You can't just like hear the synopsis and get the same point of view.
Yeah, it's actually, I remember when I started hearing about Blinkist. Have y'all heard about that?
Yes, that's what, like, that reminded me of.
How would you describe it? It's like audiobooks in 5 minutes or something. Like, it gives you a summary of the book.
Cliff notes for nonfiction.
Yeah. Is it only nonfiction? Yeah, I remember when
I
remember when I saw that, I thought, oh, that's really efficient. And then I thought about it more. I'm like, wait, if I just get a book summary, will the lessons actually stick? I would probably just forget it like in the next day or something. But I used to think that some books could just be a blog post, and some can be, but I've had some where each chapter continues to build on the previous. And I'm like, oh, I can see why this is important. I'm not going to reference this years later, like somehow Alex references these books he's read, but like, I don't know if those lessons would stick with you if you just read a 5 minute Cliff Notes and got an AI summary of it.
I think a good heuristic is that if you can distill a book into 5 bullet points, it's probably not worth reading.
Yeah.
Especially if the lessons are obvious, then it's just skip the book and do it. Just do the thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you didn't need to read the book. You were productively procrastinating anyway. It's like, that's probably a good heuristic. It's like reading Anti-Fragile, you know, you can't really encapsulate the ideas into a single sentence. It's like it goes through so many illustrations of it that reading it was well worth reading once and twice and three times. But I'm trying to think, like, there's probably a lot of pop psych books that you get in the airport where you're like,
you read Anti-Fragile 3 times?
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
I've read Black Swan twice. Yeah. I like to reread like the densest books. Alchemy, I've read a couple times that I really want to ingrain in my brain and like have as an operating system. But there's some books, I would say, especially more of the self-help and productivity books, that you already know the concept. You just haven't faced you haven't embodied the courage to actually do what you know to do, you know? And that's where I see like a lot of those Blinkist things. I don't know. I've never used Blinkist, but I would imagine if you can summarize it so succinctly that it's like, you know, like a book could say like, do hard things. It's like, well, yeah, go fucking do hard things. Don't read a 200-page book about it. That makes sense to me.
Hey, I love that David Goggins book.
That was a good one because it was a memoir. There's some new one about doing hard things, isn't there? It's like about the misogies and something like that. Yeah, it's a good message because it's like I do feel like, you know, we sit on laptops all day and air conditioning, and it's probably beneficial to get out of your comfort zone and do some hard things. But at the end of the day, like, don't we all know that? Can't we just like go do the hard thing?
I guess not.
I don't know. Maybe you need motivation from time to time.
I found my hard thing I'm going to do. I don't think I told you both yet. I'm going to do it's called the Presidential Traverse in New England. So it's like a 16-hour hike straight. Might be 16 to 20 hours, but that's going to be my
incredible
physical challenge this year. Because Alex,
when are you doing that?
3 weeks.
In 3 weeks?
My friend just texted me. He's like, hey, you want to do this? I'm like, wait, I'm down.
Have you trained?
I'm fine. I'll be fine.
Is this right before your offsite?
No, it's going to be, wait. Yeah, it's going to be right before. So
damn.
I will not injure myself.
You're going to be hiking and then I have to sit on a plane for like 10 hours. You better stretch.
I'll be fine. Yeah. But Ali, you mentioned our team offsite and like your conversation with Ben. Mm. Do you want to go into that? What did y'all talk about? Like the automating stuff and then like the team culture and remote and all that?
Well, I think we should talk about the offsite in general. I think we talk about offsites every time we do them, but man, it is so good to be in person. Mm-hmm. Like it's so good just to like, I feel like remote work and it's top of mind for me. Cause in this interview I just had, we were talking more like culture values and he's like, I've been in a remote team for a long time, but starting to feel so drained. And I used to love it being on my own, working autonomously, working whenever I wanted to, but I just feel so alone. So he was really like checking on how we manage our culture, our remote culture and all that stuff. And I just was able to relate to that because I've been remote my whole career, but lately it's just felt so, I don't want to use the word transactional, but you have to make the most of every meeting. You have a lot of heads down time. Like we do prioritize autonomous working, but anyway, getting together in person, you're just doing life together for a number of days. And so you end up like interweaving personal and work conversations in a way that like really depressurizes everything. You don't have to make a decision in 30 minutes. You don't have to like set the goal for the meeting or whatever. And that stuff is very valuable. But he and I were talking, I think it was over drinks the first night when we went to that cocktail bar. And I was just asking how the team's feeling about everything, how much everything's changing and all this stuff. And he's like, the team's really pumped about automating the stuff they don't want to do anymore. But there's some stuff they feel very protective over because they know how much it gives them confidence when it comes to their work. And so we were kind of breaking down those two buckets and then seeing how the team like responds to the ideas they bring to the table and how they've been testing some stuff. Some stuff's been working, some stuff's not. But we just kind of kicked back and forth about how we feel as a company. Because he asked me, he's like, what do you guys think about automation? And we talked about the little stuff we've been automating, some of the big stuff that we've been thinking about. But in terms of our SEO and our strategy work, we landed on kind of that 50-50 bucket with the more manual stuff being preserved as such because of its value across the whole client relationship. I'm excited to see how the team continues to iterate though, because I know that they still have more that they want to try. And as we bring on these junior folks and maybe the ideas that they bring to the table, like I kind of told them it should be an always on thing. Like there's so much in flux right now. So it seems like we're doing a lot, but I don't want to just like set it down in Q3 and be like, okay, we're done automating. Like that just really shouldn't be the way it goes. I want to keep testing and seeing what works and
Yeah, I try to automate a lot of things that don't work. Like I try to use AI a lot of things too. I'm like, yeah, that ended up being a waste of time. I'm just going to go back to doing it how I was planning on doing it.
But then if it works, it's like worth it.
Mm. Yeah. 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 The offsites are interesting for me because in my mind, like our organization is like a ball of energy. And after a lot of change, it starts getting like a little chaotic. You can barely tell it's like a sphere anymore. And then we meet in person and we hash things out. We get in a room, we talk about everything. And then that ball kind of becomes a little bit more structured. Not like perfect, of course, because that's not a good way to like build a business being so rigid, but a lot of the tension and like the confusion and nuance that's missed gets cleared up. Cause I remember talking to Ben and Sam and I think there was a perception that a lot of us were misaligned on some things. And it was based on a sentence that was said here and there. And then after we had that workshopping session in WeWork, we got out, we were walking outside and I asked Ben how he felt about things. He's like, you know, I actually realized we're more aligned than I thought. It's just these random sentences that are said that there's in 30 minutes, like you don't get a chance to get through everything. And so I used to question whether we should keep doing offsites in general, but now I'm like, okay, if it's once or twice a year and it means getting this clarity together and feeling like we're all aligned and on the same page, totally worth it. And then we also just get to hang out and not just talk about work all day. Cause what I miss that you're kind of referring to, Ali, is I was not remote my entire life. I was remote before I did go to an office, but when you're in person, everyone's more multidimensional. Mm-hmm. But when you're remote, your calls are just, it's mostly work. So it's feels a lot more one-dimensional, which is not conducive to like good working relationships, I think.
I think that the more we grow and the bigger the challenges that we face and the more we work on that, we don't know what we're doing, which is fun, But, you know, it's a different challenge than I think we had 2-3 years ago. The more important it is that we like bounce ideas off each other or admit, like, I need to just talk about this out loud. You know, I need to just like get out of my head and detangle it. And you don't really get that, you know, remotely. I'm sitting in this room and I'm like, I suck. I can't figure this out. You know, but if you were like across the hallway, I could just be like, David, I need to just run this by you. And then 5 minutes later, I'd probably feel better. So I think the offsites are really conducive for that. And I think the one we had last month was perfectly timed with everything that we're going through. Like we really hashed out a lot in like 6 hours. And I do think that we pivoted really well and we're in this new phase. And it is still a lot going on. Like we're still rebuilding, but it just feels a lot smoother. Like I feel like we're all very connected. We're very aligned with our priorities. I think the offsite was a big part of that.
I think that there's a lot that people like online, I feel a little bit like I'm wasting somebody's time if I am pinging them for something non-urgent or work-related. But I think there's a lot of value in what is often perceived in the left brain as wasted time. Like people mm-hmm. who don't understand the value of small talk don't understand how much information you're gathering through small talk. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like if everything's pointed, direct, and for a purpose, it feels very like teleological. It feels very cold, stiff,
transactional.
I think it's even less about the spiritual components. And I think you gather so much information through what feels like wasted time and conversation that is irrelevant. Like that's why I'm a long form guy at heart. Like I think there's the people who want like a 10-minute tactical podcast. I think you're kind of missing the point, which is when you get somebody to talk for an hour and a half, you don't understand just what they did. You understand how they think about it. Mm-hmm. And I think you get that information in situations like this. And then the communication point, David, do you think it's merely that we're missing depth and nuance sounds like too generic of a word, but mm-hmm. I'm imagining online communication being much like you have a book, a page from a book, and you only see the first sentence of every paragraph, which presumably would give you a structural understanding of what the page is about, but it doesn't give you the contextual understanding for why on each point or like the underlying reason. So when you're saying, hey, we want to automate this process, what goes unheard is how that fits into the broader go-to-market, how that aligns with what we're hearing in sales calls, how that's effectively going to make this team's job easier because it front loads X, Y, and Z. And then getting together, you kind of hear all of those things and you're like, oh, I get it. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yes. And on an even simpler level, one might interpret that we need to automate this entire process end to end. But what I would mean is, can we just automate parts of this? Like what parts of it are automatable? That's candidly, like one of the things that I find, whether it's talking to prospects or even our team, there seems to be a binary view of automation, like all or nothing. I'm like, no, it's piecemeal, right? Like what are the steps that can be automated versus imagining this agent that does everything end to end and replaces all your thinking. Mm-hmm. That was like just as an example of something even less in depth than like the context of all of that. It's just how is that sentence interpreted? And then is there space to then be like, what do you mean by that? Well, what do you mean? What do I mean? You just automate parts of it and have that conversation of like, what do you even mean with those words beyond mm-hmm. at a much simpler level? Yeah.
There's something really interesting. And I'm sure this exists in full office in-person work too. But I think a lot of people want more information. That's probably true. Like everybody in a company wants to know more about everything else. Is that like generally a rule of thumb? Right. Like
I hope so.
I assume
Quincy on the strategy team wants to know more about editorial, who wants to know more about what we're talking about in sales. Like that mm-hmm. presumably everybody wants to know more and have more of a transparent information culture, right? Mm-hmm. But at the far end of that extreme is essentially indigestion, in that if you know everything, it's very hard to pinpoint what is valuable or what you should be focusing on. In fact, like I enjoy it nowadays when I don't know certain things. That's actually very effective for my job because then I can focus on driving value where I drive value, and hopefully things get escalated. And that's where you build systems, you know, leadership and like you know, I need to hear about this client when this happens, but not when this happens. You make that decision. And that's like how you give autonomy and, and authority over, you know, owning decisions and whatnot. I think it's like there's such a conflict in how much information is shared and how it's shared in a virtual culture that doesn't exist as much in in-person culture. Does that make sense? Because sometimes when we make decisions, they're because me or you two or one of us has a much greater clarity and we've seen more and heard more and we have more information than would be responsible or even effective to communicate. Like, could I distill the 100 sales conversations I've had over the past year, the convos with VCs, the meetups, et cetera, that then get distilled into this directional activity that we've taken on, right?
Yeah.
Like that would be absolutely overwhelming to communicate at an all hands, let alone, the breadth that I would need to communicate those things. So I don't know what point I'm trying to make there, but I think that it's more extreme in online cultures where everything tends to be a little bit more bullet pointed and there's not really room to kind of like communicate the different levels of vision and where you're seeing versus where this person's seeing things.
I guess I'm trying to draw a tangible example and let me know if this is the right interpretation. Like, let's imagine there's 20 of us in an office, pretty small office. We can hear all our conversations. Like, I can hear all your calls, Alex. Like, I can hear all of Ali's sales calls. I keep hearing that you're talking about GEO. Maybe Quincy's also there and he hears it. Mm. Maybe after the call, he's like, hey, I heard GEO come up. Like, what's up with that? Mm-hmm. And over the course of weeks, we refine how we talk about it. And because Quincy's hearing it all passively, once we make a call of like, here's how we're going to pitch this service, he's like, oh, I get it. Mm-hmm. But because we're remote, Quincy or any other team member doesn't hear all that.
Yeah.
And when we say, here's how we're going to pitch GEO, it's like, wait, where did this come from?
And maybe there's some even confusion on like, what is like so different or what is the same versus like, you hear that sales call and I'm like, oh yeah, they were talking about how they want brand mentions and something. And then the person could be like, oh, like the thing we already do, but we could, okay. Yeah, I got you. Like there's a little bit more, you're like, oh, I'm not as like concerned about this being a completely new direction or something like that.
Like they're minding like their sphere. He's thinking about delivery, for example. So he's like, I'm hearing you sell this. We're not yet delivering it, but I've already thought about it because that's been a repetitive thing for the past week. And then when we bring, you know, a new deal to the table that has that as part of the scope, he's like, I've already thought about how to do this. Whereas now we have to like figure out how to roll it out and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's more communication, more information to share.
Yeah.
You have to be much more intentional, I think, with the remote communications.
Yep.
Whereas I think you can be a little bit more ad hoc and informal with in person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Being ad hoc remotely causes a lot of challenges. I've learned. I've tried not to do that. But like even, and I think going back to the offsite, it was super helpful even just hearing like Ali, your conversations with Ben and Sam around some of the stuff I had no context about because like Alex, I decide to put most things out of my mind unless if I'm needed now. And maybe that's a part of growing up or becoming a better leader. But that was helpful because oftentimes I'm like, hey, I have no context on how we got here. Can you just like lay it all out for me? I'm like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But I didn't need to ask that because the conversation just happened live. So conclusion, get in person time.
In office.
Face-to-face time.
Should we get an office?
I think we could probably find an office in Soho. I've been looking. Got a couple spaces
very
in mind.
Very affordable.
Move. That's right.
Move to New York.
I think a thing that came up related to like the conversation at the offsite, it was more of a realization I had going into it was that we as in marketing teams, other agencies, marketers in general, we're kind of figuring things out as we go. And the sentiment I've gotten from a lot of my calls from marketing leaders is they feel behind and they feel like everyone else has figured it out and they don't know what they're doing. And I try to be the voice of reason. I'm like, hey, you're not that far behind, but here are some things that you can be doing. And I don't know the exact point I'm trying to make, but it kind of goes back to this being like a strategic partner thing where this moment for marketers and people in SEO is actually the moment to be strategic because you kind of have two options. It's either be the first mover and like make some mistakes, waste some time, waste some resources, but be learning and gathering data on what works right now and what doesn't. And then the other option is wait for someone else to figure it out. And then you follow suit once it's figured out and there's no more arbitrage opportunity. I feel like a lot of people are in that second bucket right now where they're like, hey, we don't really know how much to budget for this, or like, is this tool worth it? Whereas I think we fit in the first bucket where we're just like, yeah, $200 per month for a tool. Let's go try it out. See if it's even worth it. Shut it down in a month if it's not. Or like, yeah, let's try this. Alex, you mentioned you're doing some experiments on our site that you haven't shared details about, but like, let's just go try it and then see if it works. And if it doesn't, great. We learn something. And if it does, then we can try it out for clients.
Yeah. I like to tinker in the background every now and then and not talk about it all over LinkedIn, you know? I love that idea. The whole like you're behind narrative is so fascinating to me. I just read the Untethered Soul, so like forgive me for being a little bit more spiritual and philosophical today.
That's a good one.
It's been a weird week. But first off, I've been spending a lot less time on LinkedIn and on social media generally. I still post. I still think it's important to be top of mind, invisible, and to beat the drum on your ideas. I think like there's a lot of conversation that happens there. And if you're not present, it's hard to like maintain the idea that you exist and your ideas are smart. So I still think that's important. Mm-hmm. But what I've gotten is like a little bit less mimetic desire to try to appeal to my peers. And I've been much more heads down focused on driving value for our clients and for our team. But this idea that you're not behind is fascinating to me. One, I think it's because we're all too aware of what everybody's doing. And I think everybody's got a megaphone and they're trying to make themselves look very good, which is like a natural incentive on LinkedIn. I don't think we would post on LinkedIn if it made us look like total losers, any of us, right? Like even vulnerable posts, it's kind of strategically set up to make you look vulnerable and relatable. You're still curating a public perception. So just know that as you're interacting with everybody online, it's going to make you feel a little shitty, just looking at what everybody else is doing.
Kind of icky, yeah.
This yeah. Untethered Soul thing, I'm trying to how do I even communicate this idea? It's like, you probably are behind. What if you are behind? Like, let's just like operate on that presumption. So what? Mm. We're like, what are you going to do about it? You know, it's like, are you going to freak out? Are you going to, it's like you have this story of yourself, like the ego and attachment, and then the things you want to do and get done in the world. And it's like, you could be preoccupied your whole life with this idea that you're behind. Oh shit. Like I'm paralyzed. I don't know what to do. Or you can accept that, which is like how most of us feel. And in some sense, it's probably right. Like I don't know everything. I am weakly skilled in many areas that I could be better skilled that would help our business. But it's like, I don't want to spend all of my time thinking about that. I kind of just want to like roll up my sleeves, tinker a little bit, know that I'm an amateur and kind of move forward in some iterative way, you know?
I like that because I feel like most people are either like, oh no, don't worry about it. You're not behind. Or they're like, there's no such thing as behind. Like mm-hmm. we're all moving on different vectors. And it's like, no, I mean, you probably are a little bit behind, and that way of thinking is what's keeping you there. It's a refreshing like third way and to look at it. But that book, man, it's been a few years since I've read it. It messed with me up a little bit. I don't remember all the details, but there's a few things that I'll never forget. So we'll have to talk about it later.
I would say it's a very, very, very powerful philosophy, especially when you actually try to enact it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, mm-hmm. like the hardest thing is when you, because it's all about like kind of letting go and like the, you know, the ego versus the thing itself, the self-perceiving, mm-hmm. you know, experiences. And when you go through something that you don't want to go through, that's when you actually enact it. Then you're like, oh shit. Well, in this context, it would be the feeling, right? Like this insecurity, potentially fear, right? Like there's emotions and stories and thoughts that come into your mind around this stuff, but I'm behind. I'm going to get fired. I'm going to, you know, whatever like the thought patterns are.
Yes.
The hard part about the Untethered Soul is that you have to look those in the face and just yeah. know that they're not actually you, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can't just distract them away with like life stuff, which is what most people do.
Exactly. But yeah, in some sense, everybody, you know, is behind in some way. So it's like, even if you're a black belt in a martial art, like you still have a lot that you don't know. So to rest on your laurels is irresponsible too. It's sort of a delusional self-confidence, or not even a self-confidence. It's really just a defense mechanism, right? It's saying, no, I'm okay, like where I'm at, and therefore I'm going to do nothing. Well, that's not the right path either, right? But it's also not to be always feeling like you're inadequate. Like there, you know, like Ali, your phrase, the middle way, I like that a lot.
It's also like cool. Like there's, if you're not excited by all the shit you don't know, like why, like what are you doing? Mm-hmm, you mm-hmm. know, like, are you just cool to just stop now and just be done at 31 or whatever age you're at? I think I have shared this sentiment on LinkedIn a couple times, and I feel like it makes me sound like a big geek, but I have to believe that how we're feeling right now is how like early SEOs felt like way back when Google was born and people started figuring out how it works, and it started to become like an integral part of how people grow their business. And people are like, oh, we're history in the making and all this stuff. And I'm like, I kind of think that's true. Like, I think we're learning some really cool shit right now, and it's scary. And obviously people who are responsible for certain metrics, you know, losing their jobs to all this stuff, like that's not cool. But it, for those of us who get to play and tinker and learn and like create frameworks and a lot of new ways of working, it's kind of exciting. I think it's something to be embraced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially if you meet the universe where it is, not where you wish it was, you know?
Yeah.
Cause it's like, like you can make a mark, but like you can't really architect your environment to completely map to what you want it to be. You know, mm-hmm. that's a very naive way to look at the world. It's like, you can wish that AI overviews weren't eating click-through rate, but like, it's fucking reality. So like,
what are you going to do about it?
What are you going to do about it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely the perfect moment for anyone who says like, I'm a lifelong learner or I'm always learning. Like, great. This is a fun new thing to learn. And I think it goes back to like doing hard things and being able to work through these challenges. Like, yeah, some people might be concerned about getting fired or whatever, but that happens. There's some stuff in your control. There's some that's not. But it all comes back. I keep thinking of the phrase like beginner's mind. Like, I try to find new things to try and suck at. Mm-hmm. So I tried archery. I tried music production. First of all, producing music is so freaking hard. There's so many variables that go into it. Like, I downloaded like the software, and there's all these controls and knobs, and I'm like, oh my God. Okay, cool. I don't know if I want to do this anymore. But it introduced me to that feeling again of like, oh yeah, this is how I kind of feel at work some days. Mm-hmm. Like there's so much happening all at once, and you either figure it out and you roll with the punches, or you go do something else. And I think we've been rolling with the punches.
It really is like an era of adaptable or agile is kind of like the theme, which I think most people agree is a virtue. It's a value, not maybe in the extreme, but like to adapt to circumstances. It's interesting because back to the identity concept, like, or the ego and like kind of the story you tell yourself around the work. Some of the jobs that people are afraid of losing are new jobs, in the sense that they've only existed for 10 to 20 years. And that's a very fascinating thought. Again, I'm not rooting for jobs to go away, but you should look at the arc of history and realize that like a lot of what we do now didn't used to exist. And some of the root level skills are part of those jobs. Like if you take like a social media manager, right? That's a relatively new career. It's like the skills that went into that existed before, like writing, communication, engagement, you know, like with a community building in a sense. Those jobs will likely still exist, but like they may change. You're seeing that in a sense with the sort of blog writer. I don't know if it's entirely changed. There's a lot that's, the dust is still settling, but you're seeing this concept come out that's like a content engineer, which is like a hybrid, you know, sort of content marketer, editor, and then a systems thinker who can kind of build processes by which you can, you know, pull ideas through a workflow and repurpose them to different formats. And it's like the raw ingredients are there. So if you just like slightly alter or let go of that ego or like identity, you can adapt fairly easily. And I'm seeing a lot of people, I don't know if it's just like our age or you know, the time and like the AI era, but I'm hearing a lot of people who are going through major career changes or, you know, I don't know what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And they'll tell me about all the stuff that they're thinking about. And it's funny because from an outside perspective, I can often see a couple paths where I'm like, you would be perfect for this. Like you've done this your whole career and you're only thinking in this lane. But if you literally just step like 2 feet to the right, mm-hmm. Oh my God, it's perfect. You know?
Yeah. I had a similar conversation with Lisa, for listeners. That's my partner. And it was just exposure. Like she was thinking about the roles that she's looking for right now. And she described her previous role. And I said, oh yeah, if you're trying to go into software, cause she was in pharma and biotech, like that's a client success role. Like you're working with product management, engineers, sales teams, and you're figuring out like implementation for the software. She's like, but that wasn't my title. I'm like, yeah, but that's your skill set. Like the immutable skill set that won't change. Like this is what you're really good at. That translates to client success and like cross-functional project management. But if someone were focused on only what they did and their career, it's kind of like tunnel vision. Like you think that that's what you just keep doing, but there's so many, lateral movements you can make that probably are very well suited to your skill set and might even like be a good opportunity that no one else is looking at. Like that happened with the Clay stuff, right? Like people saw Clay, they're like, I can do so much stuff with this, but it wasn't a role that existed before. And all of a sudden there's like Clay agencies and
Clay agencies.
Engineers like that. Clay agencies, yeah.
Clay books. Nothing blows apart your sense of identity like becoming a business owner or entrepreneur. Cool. It's the ultimate example of like, if you're
I'm just like, yes, 100%.
Because, well, if you hold on, if you cling to your identity, you're going to probably tunnel yourself into solving the wrong problems and ultimately suffer because of that. It's like you have to readjust constantly and figure out what the most important problem is and then restructure your identity to solve that problem. I don't know. Like I feel like because I came up in growth marketing, it was a broad enough role that I didn't get too attached to an identity. But I do remember when I left experimentation, I felt that was hard to let go of because I knew I was going to have to stop talking about that as publicly and stop hanging my hat, like my personal brand on that identity. Mm. If I wanted to move forward and build, you know, an SEO organic growth agency. But you have to, like, I can still carry some of the models and like the analytical tools and frameworks. And I think we've built some of those into how we do SEO, interestingly enough, but I couldn't maintain the identity of an experimentation professional and move forward in my life and career.
Mm. I don't know if we've actually talked about this, but like I'm getting chills because I had the same intentional decision as like I put in all this effort to go into product management and then I had to be like, well, I suppose this is the point where I separate with that identity because it's no longer serving me. And if anything, it's going to confuse people. So I am no longer a product manager. And
interesting.
I enjoyed talking about it. Like whenever it comes up, I love geeking out about it, but it was actually an intentional decision. I had a conversation with myself and I'm like, David, you are no longer a product manager. Stop talking about product management. That is not what the agency does. That is not your expertise anymore. You're like a business owner. Like you do what the business needs. If anything, mm-hmm. I'm closer to a salesperson now.
I didn't realize that you guys had, I knew you all were more like public facing than I was earlier in your careers and at HubSpot, but I don't think I ever felt very intertwined with being like a writer or whatever. I knew very early on that it was like a stepping stone for me. I still love doing it, but I think I just grew up around business ownership my whole life. It looked very different than what we're doing now, frankly. And so I think that becoming like not becoming a new person every day, but like solving a new challenge every day and like every day is a little bit uncomfortable. That's just so true. Like what you said, Alex. I often tell like my husband, Austin, I'm like, this experience and motherhood will make me is making me what I am. Like, it's like building me as like a person, as a woman, as like a career person. I don't know. It's just very foundational and hard. And I feel like you break like every couple of months and you have to like pick yourself back up. And
definitely like the experiences that you have to face, because you ultimately, I think building a business is fascinating because you don't really have anything to fall. No one's coming to save you, right? So like if there's a hard decision to make, you got to do it yourself. And I think that builds like confidence, emotional maturity, wisdom. Like some of the things that I do regularly now, I used to be terrified of. Like getting on a sales call, I was so nervous my first couple because I've never done sales. Like, who am I? And now it's like, you know, I'm getting into like, I've done several presentations for C-suites at big companies. And sometimes I have to tell them really hard news or like something that's like not easy to tell them. And it's like, fuck, like who else is going to do this? You know, you just have to step up to the plate and make
like
that.
The team's looking to you to communicate that.
Yeah. For me, the turning point was when we started hiring, and then we have this team now, and I'm like, this is people's careers. Like, we're literally creating careers, and it's like, so it's such an honor, and it's so intimidating at times. And I'm so protective of our team and like, I'm so proud of them, but that's what it got super, super real for me, because all of my entrepreneurship experience before this was like freelancing, which is like quasi entrepreneurship. And then my own business in college, which was just me. So it's just a whole other level now.
Mm-hmm. I ultimately do think it's fun. And I think that's why we, throughout any sort of stress peaks and lulls, like we enjoy it in maybe the type two fun in a way. But it's, you know, if you compare that to the sort of clinging to a singular identity or like a type of work that you've done forever, like I couldn't imagine that path for myself either. It's really interesting.
That's why we do what we do.
Yeah. I've had a conversation a couple times with different people where they're like, oh, I've been thinking about doing my own thing for a couple of years now, but I think it's too risky. And what I've done in each situation is like, well, you feel like you're about to get laid off, or you're seeing all these layoffs happen and you can see that there's even risk in staying in your job. Like, it's not guaranteed anymore. And then there's the question of like, well, do you want to take a bet on yourself? Like, do you believe that you can do this thing? Or is there any reason to believe you can't? And I think a lot of folks, like we faced that a couple of years ago, but a lot of folks now are facing that, especially like looking at the layoffs happening. And I'm like, yo, what's the worst that happens? Like, start something on the side. And if it doesn't work out with this current job, then great. You have something set up already. Like, low risk. You've already proven it out.
Well, and it's also what do you want?
Quit and did it.
Because it's like, also if you truly want to do that and it is risky, well, you're going to make a trade-off regardless. And it's like that Emerson quote, that's like, most men lead lives of quiet desperation. It's like, if you either do it and blow up in the process, and you're probably going to learn something, and you'll figure something out, unless it's like an insane, absolutely like irresponsible risk, which like I'm obviously speaking in, you know, reasonable terms, you know, or you think about it forever and it's in the back of your mind. You're just thinking like, what if maybe someday? And like, that's also like, you know, you're going to have,
that's a risk too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like there's going to be,
life happens.
It's suffering, like no matter what.
If it's been on your mind for 3 years, just do it. Like, that's a sign. It's one thing if it's on your mind for a week and it fades. It's like, okay. But then you're sitting on it for a few years. Like, to me, there's more risk in not doing it, getting old and being like, damn, I should have done that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you got to make the leap. It's the... I remember too many quotes.
End us on a good quote.
The Hunter S. Thompson quote, buy the ticket, take the ride. It's like, what else do we have to do?
That's a great, great ending.
Nice.
Good episode.